Blog Talk Radio.
Performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth and Agony, out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest the visual artist, poet, educator, activist, and longtime source of inspiration, Kathy Flood. How are you, Kathy?
I like it. Thanks. Hi. Thanks so
much. Hi. Yeah. Kathy Flood's Wallworks installations and assemblages offer colorful narratives about contemporary urban life. A self-declared guerrilla sociologist, her tongue-in-cheek observations are expressed through her visual art writings and activism. She's been included in over 240 exhibitions in the U.S. and Europe, has served as an arts advocate, and has curated and produced visual and oral events. She's released a writing textbook and also a solo CD of her bombastic stories. She has been an art educator at secondary and university levels for 30 years, specializing in drawing and murals. First off, Kathy, I have to publicly thank you for being the poet, the beautiful person that enabled me to get my very first show at LA's finest literary institution.
Beyond Baroque.
Beyond Baroque, yes. And
I'm
always indebted to you for that. So thank you for that.
Well, you grabbed it and you flew with it, baby.
You know, as I mentioned in your bio, you're a self-declared guerrilla sociologist. What exactly does that mean to you?
Okay, well, for those listeners that don't know me, I'm not all hairy. Guerrilla is G-U-E-R-R-I-L-L-A. So when you look in the dictionary, it says a member of an irregular, usually politically motivated force that combats stronger regular forces. So basically, I'm a very anti-corporate person, and I feel, you know, that the way we're squeezed out, our individualism and expression is really diminished of late, in the last couple decades especially. And so a guerrilla sociologist would take, I think, two positions at once. One would be, I would be in the mall very happily buying pink ribbons and buying cute little things and being all absorbed in the intricacies of corporate America. But then there's another side of me, maybe more George Carlin-y or something, who would be on the outside going, this is really screwed, this is really ridiculous, and do everything that I can to kind of adbuster it out in my
right.
way. Yeah.
You know, you incorporate a lot of text within your visual work, something that I've always loved about your work. But you're also a visual artist. How do you go about incorporating your stories into your collages, assemblages, and installations?
I would say that the words come first, and then they kind of venture out, and they flirt with the images. In my case, etchings and drawings, and also everything from Victorian sources. And when they're nice and cozy, they kind of parade out as a couple, you know? And really, that one's not canned. That one I just made up.
So actually, that was actually a question I had for you. So the words actually do come first, yes?
They do, yeah, absolutely.
So then, what would be some events and situations that would, let's say, inspire the words that would then lead you to incorporate visuals?
If I see senior pranks at the high school I used to teach at, if I see bad drivers, if I see people buying things for different reasons, if I see, you know, anything that I notice that I can categorize out in the world that would trigger off me having my notepad on my lap while I'm driving and kind of making the little notes there and watching everything as it goes and honing it down later on. So it's like when I get upset out in the world at the way things are going, I can come back and kind of juice it up with a little bit of humor or a lot, depending.
Yeah.
How dry we want to be.
So who would you consider to be, while we're on the topic of writing, who would you consider to be some of your writing influences? And also, for that matter, who would you consider to be some of your visual arts influences?
Well, on the writing influences, there's a futurist, Marshall McLuhan, from way back, and he is the one who's been really important to my thinking. He's my number one, because he had this perception that the honest and raw humanity is going to diminish in the face of the electronic age. So everything that he said, I mean, I have lots of stories to kind of shore up that concept, you know, how we're changing in regards to the electronic age. As far as people who write, you know, I like the Victorianists, so I love Edward Gorey. I like Tom Robbins a lot, Spalding Gray. I like monologue people, monologuists. Yeah. T.C. Boyle, Linda Berry, and when anybody ever asks me in my life what my favorite book is, I always say Dear Theo, which is, you know, Vincent van Gogh's diary.
Oh, yes.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think I could ever say any other book was my favorite.
You know, you mentioned... Go ahead.
You mentioned... Oh, I know. You were talking about the visual...
Your visual influences. Yes, please.
Ah, well, let's see. I just have so many. I'll just say a couple that I've seen just in the real recent. I just saw Grayson Perry at Santa Monica. This is going to get into too much of a visual art conversation, but the thing is, there are a lot of contemporary artists that really, really get me going. I mean, from Lynn Foulkes to Rauschenberg.
I love Lynn Foulkes.
Yeah. And there are so many, but I'm not really one to go back into art history too much. I'm one that wants to hear the edgy narrative going on. So not as much visual, but more in the politics of the thing, you know.
Right. Well, you know, sort of while on the topic of art, how well would you say that your formal schooling, and when I say schooling, I mean your art schooling, you know, you received an MFA in studio art from CSU and the University of Washington. How well would you say that your formal schooling prepared you for the work you're doing now? And also, how would you, you know, how far would you say that you've actually broken away from those teachings?
Well, I just think that schooling hurt me, really. I mean, it took away a lot of my balls. It's... you know, when I was reviewed at the MFA, there were some comments that I was doing anti-art, but we were all sort of doing that, kind of breaking away. I went to school at a time that was kind of the bridge between following the formal principles of art and going along with everything and saluting everything about art history and this sort of, you know, deconstruction or whatever you want to call it, postmodernism, where you did whatever the hell you wanted to, so... I think that I was living up in the state of Washington. I was being a good girl and cross-hatching and doing everything fairly traditionally. When I came back to L.A. in 80, it just throw blood on it and drive over it and throw up on it and smear a skunk on it, man. Because, I mean, that's like everything changed, you know.
Right.
So it's a really good question considering that I hope none of my ex-students hear this because – you know, I really did teach for all those years, and I do believe in education very much, but I just also think that art education, because it's not funded, is not art education now, and that would get me on a 20-minute rant about the horrors of LAUSD and also state college funding.
Yeah, right. I hear you on that one. We've spoken about some of those things from time to time. So you've got your words, you've come up with some words, you've been inspired by a situation, it's inspired you to write a piece, and then you want to take those over and, you know, sort of then take those words into the visual medium. What is your method of working as far as how you then go about, maybe you could give us an example of a piece. Where you actually take those words and then build them into a piece or a number of pieces.
Okay, I just had a show at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art, and it was 16 pieces. They were 24-square-inch collages on cloth. I got, you know, I often work on antique supports, and then I put on the etchings, and then I put in all kinds of found materials, and then I throw on those words. So this one the show that just closed was called Shopper's Fatigue, The Decision Aprons. And, you know, I was addressing how hard it is to make decisions in this kind of overstimulating, complex, quickly evolving technological world. And that leans on the reality that we're performing under the influence of such corporate and media manipulation. So, I mean, how do those influences affect our decisions as we move through our days? And so I picked 16 things that I thought would be universally understood. Should I hit
right.
it? All right.
Yeah, actually, that would be great. This is a great segue. Why don't you read an excerpt or two from that
okay.
Decision Aprons? Yeah,
I can do that. So the first one addresses how far we should go for beauty and for youth. It's called Of Botox and Brow Lifts. Crawl out of your caves and get smart, girls. We got your silicone injections, your diagonal mammoplasties, and your new Blast Femi Unibrow Acid injections. No, you'll stick to a suffragette cheek pinch, a bite your lip lipstick, and a choo-choo manicure. The boys will shudder. Rearview mirrors will crack as you lumber by, and you'll never know the velvet pleasures that you should have earned. So
nice. Read another one.
Okay. The next one's about religion. Which religion, you know, shall you attach yourself to? And it's called True Believers Snack Pack. Join us for Moonlight Mass. We feverishly pray for you. Come ye Unitarian Universalists, Shintos, Neo-Paganists, Banjoists, Baha'is, Appliantologists, followers of the Sacred Sour Ball, Taoists, and the Church of the Perfumed Mind. We embrace dogmatics, theists, and scrambled souls of all types. Let us explain. So that
nice.
That is religion.
Do you have another?
Oh yeah. Out of the 16, I just picked some. Now to decide which entertainment that you would like to view, it's called audience participation. Get me instant primal on a Friday night. Stifle my work grunts and gladden the distraction. Pique me by the second set. Warble me a plain song, a symphonious swamp pop ballad. Jolt me with acid jazz or sludge metal. I ache for that crescendo, its soaring, sweating freedom to give me my history back, my pride, my furnace. Come on, Google, I'm feeling lucky tonight.
Nice. You know, speaking of audience participation, that's one thing I love about your work, is that it really kind of demands on one level or another that the audience engage with your work and participate with it. And there is a very playful aspect to your work that sort of allows, you know, that opens that door for that to happen. I was wondering if you could maybe talk about one of your pieces or a couple pieces to use as examples of to discuss the different ways people interact with your work and also interpret it.
Well, just recently at San Luis Obispo, you know, I made this work and I put it on the wall of my house in my studio, and people would come and they would glance at it and they would just see the shapes or something, and within like 25 seconds they'd go, wow, you know, some phrase, but they didn't stop really to read it. But when it's up in a space like the museum, people really did read it, and I got a chance to, you know how you kind of eavesdrop and voyeurize at an art opening, you know, because your mm-hmm. ego can swell bigger than the room, right? So I'm sitting on a bench, and it was just cute because there was this young couple that I could tell didn't hang out at museums like ever, and they were sort of like tickling each other and hanging on each other, and the woman was reading, and she said, wait, I want to read this or something, and then the guy said, oh, just come on, and they were going back and forth about, but this is weird, but it's just weird, it, you know, do you mean I'm weird? Went to this, it elicited this whole stupid, like, strange trailing conversation, and I thought, well, that wasn't my intent. My intent was these political, you know, really sincere values and morals things, but instead it ended up to be, you know, something straightforward, but it was all right.
Right. What do you want from people as they look at your work?
I want them to come back with their own experience. I want them to be a part of the dialogue and to relate to it. Like when I say what bad drivers are thinking, every single person in a car wants to know that. You know,
right.
What the hell could this person be thinking doing what he did? And I want my voice to be humorous, and I want it to be communal and accepting. Like we're all in this together, and how are we going to cope, and it's ridiculous, and we all stand in line at Fry's. We all think the same thing, but where does it get kind of put together and gelled, like, you know, jello with the fruit, like everything's all perfectly suspended, and then you can see it, you know?
Right, right. Overall, do you feel that people find the combination of text and visuals to be more enticing or more challenging?
I'm going to have to say, in L.A., in bigger cities, I think that people are maybe a little less patient, but not all of them. It's really, you know, it's one way or the other. Either people will only look at it visually, or they really do want to see what it says. So I don't know. Good question. Am I allowed one? I don't know.
Of course, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. You know, and it's something that, you know, because I've seen a lot of your work through the year, and it's definitely something, I mean, I love it, obviously, you know, because I love words and I love visuals and I love how you put them together. But, you know, I've definitely wondered from time to time, and I've watched people watch your work, you know, and it's definitely something I've wondered about and really haven't been able to really come up with an answer, you know, myself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really varied, but basically I don't want to be off-putting by being so George Carlin-y direct, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be able to have that sentiment in a digestible form so that people can really consider it. And also, I don't know about all the women that are listening, but I was raised to hide my anger. And these days, not so much, but back in the day, the worst thing you could do is say your opinion, or that would turn you into a bitch. That was the whole, like, be nice thing. And that's, like,
right.
Part of me I can't really extract, you know. So I kind of end up with this voice, you know, that does have the kind of softness or humor in it. But there's maybe you can hear the trembling, pissed off anger underneath. I don't know.
Right, right. Well, you know, speaking of that humor, you know, something that when you were reading before, I was once again reminded how your writing, you know, contains a lot of humor and a lot of lyricism. And I'm curious, how have you gone about developing those aspects of your writing, or for that matter, your personality or whatever?
I think that I study humor all the time, as much as I can get it, you know. But I'm sorry, I just forgot the end of what you were saying.
I was curious how you've been able to sort of develop it and, you know, cultivate it, especially, you know, when sometimes you're dealing with really serious issues,
mm-hmm.
but yet you're able to give it a spin that has some whimsy, some lyricism, and, yeah, how you've been able to develop that.
I don't know. I think that I'm kind of serious by nature, but I'm kind of shy for being so serious, and I'm trying to act a little groovier, and I'm trying to make this into something that, let's see. I mean, I try not to go off on limbs. I want to stay on the main track.
Right.
It's hard. You know, you're asking such a wonderful question that I haven't thought of. But I'll tell you this. In high school, I had a creative writing class. I brought back a paper. The teacher said, I cannot believe this person in my class. She's so amazing. And she read a passage in my work, and it was about a dog, right? It said an old dog. And so I typoed it, an old god. And she was going on for like 20 minutes, like, the god is a dog, is a god, before the cliche happened, I guess. And I didn't do it on purpose, but then I somehow walked out of the room and thought, I'm a writer, okay? I'm a writer, that's right. What I am.
Darn right. You know, if we talk about, let's say, the contemporary art world, you know, and I really don't know a lot about the contemporary art world, but if you were to think about the contemporary art world and your work and sort of where you stand as a person and artist, where would you feel that sort of your work fits in or doesn't fit in to contemporary art?
Well, I've decided to be not commercial. And I've decided a long time ago, because I had a day job, that public, alternative, and academic spaces were my world. And so I do go into billions of galleries and look and everything, but the whole commodification deal is kind of bizarro for me. I think that for me it really limits a lot, and I'm not into as much the formal aspects or the delicious gorgeousness. I'm not good at gorgeous like many artists. They're very lyrical and they're very poetic and succinct in their brush strokes, in their color and the way that they work. And I'm not as concerned. I'm not a conceptual person either, but I really want to try to be true to the street or however you want to
right.
say it, you know, is that I can't say anything that I'm saying if I'm addressing any kind of money-making or gallery or anything. I do sell every once in a while, but I think that I really, where I've shown mostly and what I'm most interested in is I love tiny, small museums, and I like academic spaces. I like colleges a lot and alternative spaces because there's the freedom. You know?
Yeah. You know, I remember seeing a two-room installation of yours. I think it was a two-room installation. Talk Heavy to Me at Barnes Dillard Park.
Right.
You know, and on first, and I think I had actually seen some of those pieces separate, maybe at your place or whatever. But then to see them, you know, in the installation on first glance, it was a bit overwhelming to walk into the rooms and see so much work and so much text. You know, I could have literally spent days in there mulling over each individual piece, and I was hoping you could talk a little about the project, how long it took to create it, set it up, and what you were wanting to achieve from that particular installation.
Okay, so what this is a Victorian therapy center. I made an 8 or 9 foot therapist, you know, overwhelming the space with Blotista Paradisimo, who is my alter ego.
Yeah, we're going to talk about her in a second.
Okay, and so she is in there for therapy, and she's lying on the couch. It's called a daybed, and there are affirmations and aphorisms and quotes and cliches and everything all over the walls. And I kind of got triggered off when I actually was in a therapy room, and all the walls were covered. What I was trying to do with that, and you're exactly right, I was trying to get the whole overstimulation is another big theme of mine. People just, you know, having to shut down and not being able to take it all in. So I thought when you walk in the room, if you're just so overwhelmed, it'll work. And I hope I did that because, God, all that stuff takes up like all bedroom in my house.
Yeah. How long did it take you to create the project?
I used some older work, and I worked for, I guess, a year and a half toward that. But when you do installations like this, you can always, you know, use the chairs again, use some characters, you know, change things around. So it's kind of like an ongoing story. I guess the parallel I would say would be the artist Gronk did something when Mocha Downtown just opened where he painted characters on the walls, and then he would go back every week and repaint different characters all over the place. So you can just see the show once. It was evolving and changing. So it's sort of like that with the installations that I do and the installations that I really love.
You know, you mentioned just before your artistic alter ego, Blotista Paradisimo. Could you maybe talk a little about her, what she's like, how she came about?
Yeah, so as I understand it, alter egos are sort of the opposite side of your personality. And we know a lot of people from Slim Shady, Eminem, to, I mean, J.K. Rowling, all these people, you know, make up this one best friend. And so I feel kind of bad even talking about it because it's really so inside of me. But I've declared that she's a public figure, so there you go. So being opposite from me, she is calm and she is trusting, and where I would kamikaze it out and run till I drop, she would be able to kind of maintain this wonderful pacing in her life. And oh, she's receptive and I'm more defensive, and she can see the vision and I'm busy looking at what's, you know, all these, not to put myself down, but hey. So anyway, I love her. And she was sort of born with this first installation that I did called Blotista's Resume. Blotista was sitting on her, this story that I made up, Blotista was sitting on her porch swing and she was putting on raspberry Redoux nail polish when a snake oil salesman approached her and asked if she'd like a chaw of some Basic Instinct brand chewing tobacco. And so she got real polite for a little moment and said yes, and this tobacco caused her to blow up 5 times her size. So this is what the installation you're referring to is about. She had to find a new house, a new job, and a new man, and this really was tough for her emotionally. So there was a lot of information on the walls as to how she adjusted to this change.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, you might have already answered this within what you just said, but I'm curious if you might have anything more to say on what do you feel the advantages or disadvantages, if you feel there are any, for an artist, and when I say an artist, any artist, visual artist, writer, or whatever, for an artist to see the world through an alter ego?
Well, the advantage is that you can perfect it and you don't have to go through your whole self-conscious, egotistical ramblings. You can put it off on something else, but you can shape it exactly the way that you want to and sort of, you know, learn from it. I don't really know why a lot of the people like that we could mention do have alter egos.
Right.
I don't know if it's for that same reason or not, but I don't know.
Yeah, you know, you use... Yeah, it is. I'm completely fascinated by the whole concept. You use photography, textiles, antique objects, gutter wall findings, and handmade bits within your installations and your artwork. How do you go about amassing the materials?
There's Etsy.com. There's flea markets.
Yay, Etsy.
There's my favorite thing, which is gutter walks, which is, you know, just picking up whatever you see. Depending on where you are, like the scuzzier the neighborhood, the more rich it is, you know, really. And let's see. Oh, you know what I used to do for my birthday every year is go to a car parts place and collect. There's one in Sun Valley called Pick Apart, and you just go in the glove boxes, glove compartments, they're not called that anymore, but, you know, a little shelf inside, and you walk around, you pick up, and you just put it in a bag, and by weight, they sell you stuff. So that's kind of interesting. But lately, I've been getting lists, finding people's lists of either things they're going to buy or do or whatever, and keeping them, because lists are so personal. I really love that.
Right. You know, and I think you've talked about this in, you know, when you've written about your work or in different interviews or whatever, that you have an affection for Americana, and this sometimes comes out in the pieces that you'll use within your installations. What does that mean to you exactly?
Well, I mean,
and how
I
is
think,
it embodied?
I think that I'm a typical baby boomer, you know, really. And a lot of us have a lot of creative product because when the economy was good and we were able to really nurture and grow our crafts, no matter what the craft is in any kind of art form. You know, it's just Americana in the 50s and the 60s was now especially legendary as we look back on it. Democracy
yeah, right.
was a lot more real. There was a lot more humanity, a lot more human. I mean, I'm like this old person going, I had the good old days, but there's some really great stuff now. I mean, it would be really boring now, I think, if we went in a time capsule, in a time machine backwards.
Right.
But I really admire the sincerity and the focus and the, people in the 50s, you know, they would shake hands. Pardon me. They'd have a reputation. It would matter. These are some things that are just, you know, such moral plays that I that I love to think about. And so that's kind of what I mean by Americana. I mean the old, you know, not the current form of government that we have in this country, the corporatocracy.
Right. You know, when I think of America, or at least the original ideas of America, the ideas that helped to, you know, to found this country, I think of Americans as being, you know, strong and self-reliant. But in this day and age, you know, I'm not so sure. What do you feel are some of the issues and societal changes that threaten our self-reliance?
Well, I think that people do not have a sense of place anymore, in that they can hop into any city and rent a place and start going, and they can, you know, unlike back in the day, I mean, now you can change your identity and you can change anything that you're in the mood to do, so it's not like you're actually building. We also have an incredible impatience in this country, like our work ethic has rotted in a sort of a way, but it's not the people's fault. It's sort of the rewards are not there, because when I was growing up, it would be you get a little old car and then you finally, you know, make money and you in the future deserve a new car or a little house to a big house or whatever. But there sort of isn't that mentality anymore. I guess what I see is because everybody on the planet can be so mobile now that we don't have the distinct places we did before. And I think that people are, I read an essay recently about the differences in time-space understandings in different cultures. And so when you have a freeway and you have people from all over the world, and some, you know, everyone has a different take on the way things should be and what it is that they're used to and their physical space and comfort zones and all that, there's going to take some adjustment. And, you know, that's just an idea.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm going to go back in the way back machine here. Not so way back, but back in 1996.
Yep.
Let me tell you a story, kids. Back in 1996, you did a spoken word record with Harvey Kubernick.
Right.
I don't know what he's up to these days, but back then, man, he was like the spoken word guru of sorts with New Alliance Records. You did a spoken word CD with him. I was wondering if you could talk a little about it, how it all came about.
Okay, well, first of all, what Harvey's doing now is writing books.
He wrote a
big old fat heavy coffee table book about the history of Laurel Canyon. Pardon me. And I can't remember the newest one he has coming out, but he's just pumping out books. He was the center of spoken word. He pulled people in, and Greg Ginn from Black Flag had a recording studio in Long Beach, and he actually took a bunch of us, you know, down there to record, and it was very generous of the guy, and, you know, really worked, gave a lot of us our start.
Yeah, yeah, and your CD was entitled, I love the title,
Rocky Road Peep Show and Paper Hangers Directory, Point of Purchase Dreams.
I was going to say the title, but I was afraid I was going to stumble on it. So
we should have a contest and see who can say it faster.
I passed that baton on. Passed that baton on to you. Well, why don't we go ahead and play a short excerpt from a longer piece off the CD entitled Heel Toe Without a Shoehorn.
Heel Toe Without a Shoehorn, an affectionate inventory of artists' idiosyncrasies. Van Gogh's plan. I do not intend to spare myself nor avoid any difficulties, Vincent told Theo. Her adopted flippant mantra shot through a self-taught soul, a claim to own every brow-beating cross-reference, time-gridded five-step wind plan that any card-carrying commuter could throw out with a daisy wheel. She kept orchestrating ways to win, red deadlined with ball-busting, ballpoint precision. She never spared herself, braced for the wind in air-conditioned splendor. Broken spine. The right-brained rush of foggy-gone, dizzy-flying creations so distant. The sparking of wet matches, shoved away hard, like the fear of tin can edge cuts. Instead, the preparation, stalling, setup, backswing of everything around the work. Foreplay till it hurts. She will not carry a knife or brush, but will stall the test by re-reading books turned back upon themselves while doing sit-ups. Day job. All the low-tech inventors organizing trays of Happy Meals into symmetrical track boxes, and the could-be models ruining their posture, flipping hangers and steaming socks, and the singers calling bingo, and the dancers selling shoes, and the artists writing out rainy day coupons, hold a dream outside of the time clock's purple smears. What magic soul sanitary sealed your Tampax, and who, numbed and patterned, crossed your weedy lawn today? Watch that mailman who uses your postcards as muse for the next Twilight Zone script. Our storytellers are here, disguised as footmen.
That was Kathy Martin reading an excerpt from Heel Toe Without a Shoehorn from the CD. Hit it again, Kathy.
Oh, so it's Kathy Martin Flood now, you see.
Yes, yes.
She fell in love.
Yes. But again, the title of the CD was?
Oh, Rocky Road Peep Show and Paper Hangers Directory, Point of Purchase Dreams.
Nice. Is that CD still available? Can people still find it?
Give me a call, guys.
Operators, oh, yeah. Standing by.
Oh, yeah. Just go to my website, KathyFlood.com, Kathy with an I.
Yeah. Do you ever read live at exhibits?
I do.
Oh, nice. Nice. What? And how do people react?
It depends what the situation is, but, I mean, pretty good. I mean, at least I like it.
Right. Well, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've been an art educator for 3 decades. You've taught at Cal State Northridge and Taft High School, as well as other institutions. You've received your National Board Certification, and you're the recipient of an Apple Award, Teacher of the Year Prize. You're a 2-time Music Center Bravo nominee. How would you say that your teaching career has influenced your art?
So much, so much. You know, teenagers are so honest, and I got a chance. I think the best experience with the schooling was the mural. At Taft High School, we worked for 25 years on a mural with a number 7 watercolor brushes, the very thin little brushes, and we did all the neighborhoods of L.A., and there's so many stories that go along with that. And I think that just sitting with the kids and working on the murals throughout the years gave me sort of a little better of a voice, you know, a little richer of a voice. So,
yeah.
You know.
Nice. So, final question. What would you say is the aim of your work and its ultimate message?
The ultimate message is that we need to have some sort of dialogue and working together and communal kind of attitude toward what's going on right now. And if everybody kind of closes their bedroom door and stays on the computer and comes out only when they, you know, are at their high point or something, that we're not going to get through all this. There's so much having to do with the culture, the climate change, I should say, and technology, and there's just so many changes going on that we really, and things are moving so quickly that I'd say the goal is for us to be able, you know, for I hope that I would trigger a bit of conversation or reaction from the
nice.
Sociological craziness I see.
Nice. You mentioned it before, but why don't you go ahead and say it one more time. What's the best way for people to find out about you online?
So it's K-A-T-H-I, Kathy Flood, Flood Like Too Much Water, .com.
Nice. And you also have a show coming up at the you're going to have a piece in a show at the Orange County Center for Contemporary Art, correct?
Right. That's a show about identity. It's called Compass, and curated by Amy Grimm, and it looks like it's going to be a good show.
Nice. And when's that happening?
Oh, coming up in a couple weeks, I think.
Okay. And people can find out about that on your website?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Kathy.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much. That
yeah, with me. Yeah, totally. With me today again has been the visual artist, poet, educator, activist, and longtime source of inspiration, Kathy Flood. I also want to send out a big thank you to our show's sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. And also a big thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can also find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, and Spotify. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth and Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when my guest will be writer, music critic, Weeklings contributor, and all-around great guy, Joe Daly. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.